to the Mind and Matter podcast. I'm your host, Nick Jacomas, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Chris Kenobi. Chris is a physician by training. He went to the University of Colorado for medical school and spent many years as an ophthalmologist. For the last few years, though, he's been focused mostly on research and education on diet, nutrition, and metabolic health. And he's done a lot of public speaking on this. He's got some really good YouTube lectures. He's also the author, the co-author of the book, The Ancestral Diet Revolution: How Vegetable Oils and Processed Foods Destroy Our Health. And I talked with Chris about seed oils or vegetable oils, what those are, the types of fatty acids they contain called omega-6 fatty acids, such as linoleic acid. We talked about what these things do in our body, how they're processed, how they compare to other types of fats, how they can be oxidized and lead to things like inflammation and oxidative damage in the body. We talked about the foods that contain high levels of omega-6 fatty acids, focusing mainly on seed oils. So these are industrial seed oils, things like soybean oil, things like corn oil, sunflower oil, and so forth. And we talked about how their fat content differs from other vegetable oils and all of the things that Chris believes these seed oils contribute to or are major drivers of. And that includes things like obesity, diabetes, various other chronic inflammatory conditions. He talked about how our bodies store up these fatty acids in our fat, in the cell membranes of our cells. He talked about how long it takes to actually for your body to actually get rid of these fatty acids if you stop eating them so much. We talked about why they're so common in processed foods and why they weren't very common in the ancestral state of humans. So when we were hunter-gatherers eating traditional diets out in the wilderness, basically, we consumed very, very low levels of omega-6 fatty acids compared to what we consume today. We consume a lot of these. They've been going up and up and up in our diet for well over 100 years now. And so we talked about all of the health consequences of that. And I think this is a really interesting episode that really helps you understand how and why you might want to avoid processed foods and things that contain high levels of these fatty acids. As always, don't forget to check out my Substack, mindandmatter.substack.com. I've got a bunch of written content there, including a written series I'm doing about metabolic health related to the content in this episode and some recent episodes I've done. I've got a free weekly newsletter where I provide updates on the podcast, like who's going to be on next, as well as a lot of research that I share, things that I'm reading, new studies that have come out, all to do with the topics that I like to cover on the show. And so I really appreciate subscriptions there. This episode is supported in part by Athletic Greens. Their main product, AG1, is a comprehensive and convenient daily nutrition product containing 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients with less than 1 gram of sugar per serving, no nasty chemicals or artificial anything. It's gluten and dairy free and compatible with paleo, vegan, vegetarian, and ketogenic diets. AG1 is a quick and convenient way to supplement your diet to help ensure your body is getting the nutrients it needs. It comes in powder form and you can mix it in water and drink it, or you can put it into a smoothie or a shake or something like that. I mix it into water and drink it with the first meal of each day, and it's super convenient. If you go to athleticgreens.com/mindandmatter, Athletic Greens will give you a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. Their vitamin D product comes in tincture form, so you just take one drop each day. A large fraction of the population is actually vitamin D deficient, especially in winter months when we get less sun exposure. And vitamin D is super important for the proper function of the immune system and for a variety of other things. And there's even evidence indicating that vitamin D deficiency is correlated with more severe cases of COVID-19 in those who get infected. Every time I go into the doctor each year for a checkup, I'm always told that vitamin D deficiency is very common and I should be supplementing on a daily basis. So visit athleticgreens.com/mindandmatter or click the link in the episode description. You'll get a free 1 year supply of vitamin D with your first purchase. And with that, here's my conversation with Dr. Chris Kenobi. Briefly, like how you got into the realm of seed oils and things that we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, sure, Nick. So I'm a traditionally trained physician and ophthalmologist. And I really got into this out of my own suffering, started with arthritis way back 30 years ago, and that eventually led me about 12-13 years ago to investigate that. And try not to go into too much detail here, but my arthritis led me to Lauren Cordain's book, The Paleo Answer. And from that, I determined that basically processed foods, refined flours, sugars, and vegetable oils were driving most all of the chronic diseases. And so, but there were things about Cordain's work that I didn't really agree with, didn't understand, and I just kept researching. And eventually, a couple of years later, I came across the work of Weston Price and really began to connect the dots between processed foods and chronic disease in a deeper way that made more sense to me. And that year, Nick, then I hypothesized that processed foods and vegetable oils, sugars, refined flours, all that might be driving age-related macular degeneration. I'm an ophthalmologist. Age-related macular degeneration, or AMD, is the leading cause of irreversible vision loss and blindness in people over the age of 50 worldwide. Mm-hmm. So I spent about a year and a half, or maybe almost 2 years, investigating that while I was still in practice. And in February of 2015, I was so convinced that that hypothesis held water that I left practice and pursued that full time. Mm-hmm. And so that took about another year and a half of investigation. Basically, from that, we looked at data of processed food consumption, tracking proxy markers for processed food in the form of sugars and vegetable oils, and the data in 25 nations supported that hypothesis. So I went public with that in 2016, published a paper, published a book, started a nonprofit foundation. But eventually, I kept researching all of this. And the one thing that kept occurring was that in my research was that it was the highly polyunsaturated vegetable oils that seemed to be the major drivers of overweight and obesity, chronic disease. And by chronic disease, I mean diseases like coronary heart disease, stroke, cancer, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, Alzheimer's, dementia, autoimmune disorders, the list goes on. Mm-hmm. And so I went public with that in 2019. And this is kind of where where I've been spending the majority of my time over the last 5 years or 6 years, really is processed foods and vegetable oils and chronic and overweight, obesity, and chronic disease. So that's basically my story, Nick. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when we think about chronic disease, all of the diseases of modern civilization, the things that we're commonly sick with today that our hunter-gatherer ancestors were almost never sick with, things like obesity, diabetes, different inflammation-driven conditions, you know, all the things that you mentioned. Most people, in my perception, most people agree that our diet is a big factor in this, and that mm-hmm. what's wrong with the diet has something to do with processed foods, whatever exactly those are. But, mm-hmm. you know, I want you to get into sort of your explanation for this. Can you start off by just unpacking this graph here and defining very clearly two terms, at least? One is, what are ultra processed foods exactly, in your view, and what are seed oils?
Oh, okay. And I didn't realize, I guess we have the graph up there.
Yeah.
Okay. I meant to stop sharing that and could come back to sharing it. Sorry about that. But so processed foods really, first of all, are made up of four basic things, and it's refined flours, refined sugars, vegetable oils, and trans fats. Mm-hmm. And then there's all the, you know, so-called mystery ingredients, the kind of, the ingredients that food scientists concoct in order to give flavors and such.
So that would be like artificial sweeteners and colorings and stuff like that.
Yeah, all those kind of things. But if you But I, you know, I don't know that those things are the primary problem. It's those four big components, the refined flour, sugars, vegetable oils, and trans fats that are really the main problem. And if you go clear back to Weston Price's research in the 1930s, you'll find that he connected the dots between people consuming these foods because they and chronic disease because these foods are nutrient deficient. So Price found that the population still consuming their native traditional diets, meaning they had no processed foods, those diets contain 10 times more fat-soluble vitamins. That's basically A, D, K2, and E. And 4 times more water-soluble vitamins. That's all the B vitamins and C, and 1.5 to 60 times more minerals than did the American diets of his day. In other words, there was already that much processed food
That was in the 1930s too, that he
in
was
the
contesting.
1930s, right?
Okay.
And so it's only gotten much worse since the 1930s, obviously, and so has, you know, our overweight, obesity, and all the chronic disease has ramped up just exponentially.
So, well, so a question there would be, if he was making those observations in the 1930s, and the nutrient deficiency in the U food in the US at that time was already that bad, that nutrient deficient. Why didn't the obesity epidemic start in the 1930s?
I think it did. But there's no data to support that, but it was increasing. But again, the food consumption, the processed food consumption was far lower in the 1930s, and all of the evidence points to that. But the main thing that's changed between, you know, that was relatively pretty low in the 1930s was vegetable oils, the seed oils. That was really low. And but if you look at the data beginning in the 19th centuries, just regarding overweight obesity. So Scott Allen Carson's work on prisoners, men age 18 to 80, in the 19th century, their obesity was 1.2%. So if we just use the year 1900 as a starting point, well, the next actual data is 1960. And in 1960, our obesity in the United States was 13%. So we went from 1.2% in 1900 to 13% by 1960. So 1960 is when most researchers think we didn't have a problem, but clearly the problem was already there, Nick. It was just expand. It was just expanding, and you know. So then, and then others will say, well, you know, the problem began with the U.S. government's recommendation to go low fat in 1980. And that's when it exploded, because it did. In 1980, obesity was only about was not only, but it was about 14%. And then by 2016, it's 40 or 2018, 42.5% obesity.
Yeah, I think,
Right. So
correct me if I'm wrong, but like one way to sort of think about that is, you know, this has been my observation. A lot of people look at that explosion around 1980, and then they treat like the 60s, the mid 20th century, as the baseline. And you can treat it as the baseline if you want to start there. But what you're saying is, if you go back to 1900 and before, you know, 13% should have been considered a very high obesity rate compared to the deeper history that we have.
exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah, you don't want to use 1960 or 1980 as a baseline. That would be ridiculous, because we already had a huge amount of processed foods in the food supply by that point. And obviously that's what the people are eating. So if you want to go back, you know, with any sort of hypothesis you want to proffer regarding any kind of condition or disease, you want to go back to a time when hopefully that disease was extremely rare or didn't exist, and then see what changed. And that's why you need to go clear back, like we've done, clear back into the 19th century as far as you can go, and look at these food consumption patterns in relation to obesity and all the chronic diseases. So that's kind of, as you probably know, that's what I do. But you know, the seed oils, real quick, I'll just mention while we're here that, and we I've got graphs I can show and we could look at the data, but the seed oils were really introduced into the United States right after the American Civil War, about 1866. And in 1900, they were still only about 1 gram a day. 1909, 9 grams a day. 1960, 19 grams a day. 2010, 80 grams per person per day.
80 per day.
80. So 80 grams of fat is 720 calories. It's 9 calories per gram. So that works out to be about 32% of U.S. caloric intake. Now, there's going to be some losses there, but you know, on you're still looking at about a fourth to possibly a third of the American diet is made up of vegetable oils. And those did not exist for almost all of history until after the American Civil War.
Now, sometimes you use the term seed oils, sometimes you use the term vegetable oils. Is there a difference there? And is there a preferred name or one that is misleading in some way?
Yeah, so the vegetable oils would really be all of the edible oils, essentially, or they basically throw almost all of them into that category. So if I break that down, you can look at there's seed oils really, and then fruit oils and tropical oils. I would break those down into. So the seed oils, which are the really highly polyunsaturated ones, the ones that are really high in omega-6, that would be essentially corn, canola, cottonseed, rapeseed, grapeseed, sunflower, safflower, rice bran, peanut, and sesame oils. Those are the primary so-called seed oils. And then you have the fruit oils, which would be olive oil and avocado oil. And those are much lower in omega-6. And then you have the tropical oils, which are really palm kernel, and coconut. Mm-hmm. And those are even lower in omega-6. Like the coconut and palm kernel are the lowest out of all of these oils I just mentioned. They're 2% omega-6 linoleic acid, which is linoleic acid is the primary omega-6 fatty acid in any kind of fat, any kind of natural fat. But anyway, 2% with coconut and palm kernel oils, whereas oils like canola oils around 20%, soybean oils around 56%, safflower oils like 78%.
So these things, so seed oils, cooking oils, where they're a type of vegetable oil where we have extracted the oil from the seeds of the plant through industrial processes. And in terms of the content of this oil, it's high in omega-6 polyunsaturated fats. Is that a fair basic description?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. And what are these omega-6 fats and how are they different from other fats? And what are some of the key things that we need to know about them as we go through this discussion?
Yeah, so there's three basic fats. There's saturated fat, which has no double bonds. There's monounsaturated fat, which has one double bond. And then there's polyunsaturated fats, which have two or more double bonds. And those would be omega-6 and omega-3 fats. So the omega-6 fats, have at least two double bonds, and the omega-3s have three double bonds. So the double bonds make those fatty acids, they're called, but people can just call them fats, but the double bonds make those fatty acids subject to oxidative attack. And so they're unstable. The more double bonds you have, the more unstable that molecule is, and oxidation is dangerous. So if people want to think about it, oxidation is the equivalent of rusting, like the equivalent of metal rusting. And when a fat goes rancid, like when you leave fish sitting out and it goes rancid and stinking, that's because those primarily it's omega-3 fats that have oxidized. And so they begin to stink.
So when you smell fresh fish versus rotten fish, I think everyone knows the difference there. One of them smells very unpleasant and one of them doesn't. And the way that I think about this, and tell me if this makes sense. So those fats get oxidized. We naturally perceive old fish as smelling bad. It is aversive. Presumably, there's an evolutionary reason for that. Our senses are telling us don't eat that thing.
Right.
And so what is actually bad about the oxidized polyunsaturated fats?
Well, yeah, so good question, Nick. What's bad is the fact that the oxidized molecules, when those polyunsaturated fats undergo oxidation, they end up producing what are called advanced lipid oxidation end products, or ALs. And those advanced lipid oxidation end products are things like 4-hydroxynonenal, malondialdehyde, carboxyethylpyrrole, acrolein, 9 and 13-hode, which is hydroxyoctadecadienoic acid. Nobody ever wants to hear that again. And then there's literally hundreds of others. And that these lipid scientists, would name as chemicals, but they don't really have ordinary names like I just gave for the others. But these advanced lipid oxidation end products are very dangerous to consume. They're the equivalent. So let me draw the analogy that they're the equivalent of smoking, of burning tobacco, smoking, in other words. And so when you burn tobacco, you start off with a dried tobacco leaf and you burn it and you end up with more than 6,000 chemicals. And inside, from that, you end up with all sorts of mutagens and carcinogens. And right. And everybody knows this. And it's the same thing when fatty acids oxidize, you end up with all these advanced lipid oxidation end products. And these are also dangerous, just like the end products of burning tobacco. And so collectively, these advanced lipid oxidation end products are cytotoxic, genotoxic, mutagenic, carcinogenic, atherogenic, thrombogenic, obesogenic, and diabetogenic. So this covers the gamut of almost everything that goes wrong in chronic disease. Now, this is not the only reason. We can talk about oxidation in more detail, but that's just one of the things that goes wrong when fats oxidize, and even before you eat them. But when you eat these fats, Nick, the omega-6 fats, well, any of the polyunsaturated fats, ultimately your body will accumulate these. And what ends up in your cell membranes and inner mitochondrial membranes and in your body fat, for example, all of those reflect what you have been eating in terms of the ratios of those fatty acids over the past 3 years. Mm-hmm. And so, it would be nice if we didn't accumulate these omega-6s, but we were meant to, because they normally in natural foods, they exist in very small quantities. And so we needed, the omega-6 linoleic acid and omega-3 alpha linolenic acid. Those are the two essential fatty acids. We need those for a number of processes. And so those are called essential fats. Mm. But with every single thing that we consume, there is a sweet spot essentially for that. There's a dose that's appropriate for that. And when you get a high dose of omega-6 linoleic acid, it accumulates in your body. And this sets up this biological milieu that's ripe for oxidation and ultimately to cause harm within the body.
And So you started to talk about this, but I just want to explicitly lay this out for people. When we consume fatty acids, where are those fat molecules going in our bodies? How much of them, is some of it going to triglycerides that we have as stored body fat? Some of it's going to the phospholipid bilayer of our membranes. Are there any other places? And how much is kind of going to these different areas?
Well, you're going to... If you don't burn it, mm-hmm. you have to store it. Mm-hmm. And you're going to store it everywhere that you have fat. So cellular membranes, inner mitochondrial membranes, your adipose, in your brain, in your retina, every place that has fat, you will begin to accumulate fatty acids that are reflective of what's in your diet. Mm-hmm. And so that's what sets us up, you know, for disaster. If you consume too many carbohydrates, let's say, you know, if you consume a huge bolus of carbohydrate, for example, what you'll do is you'll top off your glycogen stores in your liver and in your muscles. And once those are all full, then you'll need to do something with that extra glycogen, right? That extra carbohydrate. And your body can convert that into fat. In fact, it does all the time. This is why at one point, way back in the 1920s, researchers thought that we didn't actually need any fat at all in the diet because they knew already by that point that we could convert carbohydrate into fat. But your body preferentially takes those carbohydrates and converts them first into saturated fat and second into monounsaturated fat. But you cannot make the omega-6 linoleic acid or omega-3 alpha-linolenic acid, those two 18-carbon omega-6 and omega-3 fats, respectively. This is why those are essential to the body.
When, you know, when we look at the diets of traditional hunter-gatherers of different kinds, and we look at the ancestral diets that humans had, the things that we were eating before we had obesity epidemics and skyrocketing rates of diabetes and all of this sort of chronic inflammation that we have today, what did the fat profile of those diets look like compared to ours? What percentage of their calories were omega-6s, for example?
Yeah, that's the really interesting question right there, because, and I've looked at this at a number of ancestrally living populations, so hunter-gatherers, subsistence agriculturists, and horticulturists. And no matter what population you're looking at, whether they're extremely high fat, like the Inuit, which were once called Eskimos, or the extremely low fat diets of like the Papua New Guineans of Tuquesinta, or the Japanese, or the Okinawans, which are again are a subset of the Japanese. But no matter what, any of these diets, if they're ancestral, in other words, they don't have any seed oils, they don't have processed foods, they don't have seed oils, all of those diets are under 2% omega-6 linoleic acid.
Less than
And
2% of calories.
2% of total calories, exactly.
What are we at today?
And we're at, by 2008, we're at 11.8%. So we were at, I might have a graph handy here for that, but I'll show you this real quickly. This is our vegetable oil consumption, because this will kind of fall into place. You can see here that we, for those who are able to see this, at 1865, we had zero vegetable oils in our diet. 1900, this is where we were about 1 gram of vegetable oils. 1909, we bump up because soybean oil. So first we just had cottonseed oil, and then soybean oil came into the food supply in 1909. And that really bumped up consumption to 9 grams a day. Over here by 1960, as I mentioned, we're at 19 grams a day. And by 2010, we're at 80 grams per person per day. And this is and I'll just mention while we're on this. So in 1900, and we didn't really go through this yet, but that was a time when there was no coronary heart disease, essentially. There was no macular degeneration. There had never been a case of Alzheimer's or dementia that wasn't syphilis related.
Well, I want to dwell on this for just a second, because it's almost like alien to think about this given how we live today and our state of health and disease. When you say in 1900 there was like virtually no coronary heart disease, people, you're saying that adults were basically not having heart attacks and things like this.
They weren't. That's exactly right. Nowhere in the world. There was eight, there's either eight or nine papers, I think it was, in the entire 19th century, 1800 to 1900, on coronary heart disease. There was only two of those were on thrombotic coronary heart disease, which is the equivalent of a heart attack. Sir William Osler, the most probably famous physician of all time, one of the founding partners of Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, reviewed his own personal history in 1897, for example, and he had witnessed about a half a dozen cases of angina. He had never witnessed a heart attack. In 1908, he gave a presentation in London, England, and he had witnessed an additional 208 cases, I think it was, of angina. He'd still never witnessed a heart attack. In 1912, James Herrick, physician, published the first known case of myocardial infarction heart attack in the United States. It was documented with autopsy evidence. Nobody even took it seriously for until about 1922 because they didn't know what heart attacks were. They didn't know what coronary heart disease was.
Yeah, that's just why. I mean, that's just why you have to think about living at a time where like no one would have even known what a heart attack was. But like today, you know, everyone knows multiple people in their life that have had.
Yeah, kids know what heart attacks are because that's how common they are. Or at least, you know, heart disease, they, you know, kids could vaguely understand that. And but by the 1930s, coronary heart disease became the leading cause of death. And in fact, here's a graph on that. And you can see there's the red line there with those are heart disease deaths. Now that's total. That would include given that it's just heart disease deaths, that would include those that are valvular, meaning, you know, coronary heart valve related deaths. But you can see that there was they were extremely unusual back in 1900, any kind of heart disease death, but exploded over the next century, right?
Yeah.
And then you can see that go ahead.
I was just going to say, for those that are just listening and won't be seeing the graph here, you know, the vegetable oil line that we're looking at, basically, you know, a little bit before 1910, early 1900s, you see it kind of go up quite a bit. And that's, as Dr. Kenobi said, that's when soybean oil kind of came onto the scene. And then it continues rising, but then in about 1960, it goes up steeply again and then rises like even more quickly to the present day. And you're overlaying the heart disease deaths with that. And these two things are correlated quite clearly.
Right. Yeah. You see this really strong correlation between the vegetable oils and the heart disease deaths up through about, you know, you can see here that after about 1980, heart disease deaths start to drop off. And this is, I used to think this was, you know, due to bypasses and procedures and medicines, but I think it's primarily due to the fact that smoking has dropped dramatically. But you can see through the entire century of 1900 to 2020, you can see that, or 2010 as far as the data goes on that, but saturated fat is virtually almost a flat line.
Yeah. The entire period from 1900 to the mid 1900s, where heart disease was going up clearly, saturated fat was basically flat the entire time.
Yeah. And this is our published graph from a paper in 2017. So you could see there's that saturated fat increased about 5 grams late, you know, around 2000. It's come up just a little bit, but it's virtually a flat line. So I'm going to go back. Go ahead, Nick.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead. No, I was just going to say, like, so someone could look at this and say, okay, this is a very intriguing correlation. It's a very striking association between heart disease and vegetable oil use in the United States, but it's just a correlation. Are there any randomized control trials or any mechanistic preclinical experiments that tell us how something like omega-6 fats and vegetable oils could cause heart disease?
James DeNicolantonio published a paper with one of his colleagues just a few years ago, and it's basically about the oxidized linoleic acid hypothesis as the primary mechanism of coronary heart disease. And that is an excellent paper for anyone to read who's interested in digging into this. But it's very clear and simple that, in my view, coronary heart disease does not exist without vegetable oils. If you look at all of the ancestrally living populations who don't have really any significant heart disease. I mean, they might have rare cases of myocardial infarction, but they don't have any significant coronary heart disease, and they don't have vegetable oils. And every population that has coronary heart disease, they're consuming vegetable oils. And so, and why, you know, how does this work mechanistically? Well, I think that, you know, in a very maybe simplified view, that oxidized LDL, low density lipoprotein, is what is taken up into arteries to begin and propagate atherosclerotic plaques. And LDL in its native state, meaning when it's unoxidized, is not taken up. And so how, you know, how does LDL oxidize? Well, it oxidizes because of the fact that it takes up linoleic acid, and then that again oxidizes because of the fact that it's the multiple double bond, and it's very prone to oxidation. And then the those are rapidly pulled out of the circulation and are deposited into these plaques, which causes this atherosclerotic plaque progression. And so I think it's almost impossible to produce coronary heart disease without vegetable oils.
I see. What, so, you know, it's the oxidation of some of these fatty acids that creates a lot of the problem. And yet, so the omega-6s are essential fatty acids, as are the omega-3s, meaning our body can't produce them naturally. We have to get them from diet. So far we've been talking about some of the ways that too much omega-6s can be bad. How much do you need, and what happens if you're deficient in omega-6s going in the other direction? What is a set? What are they doing that is essential?
Well, how much is essential?
Yeah, like what is the essential
Yeah.
function that they're actually doing for us?
The essential functions are probably myriad, but what we see in animals who have been put on a 100% fat-free diet, and there's been a few humans that were also subject to the same because of intravenous feeding or some kind of feeding with entirely fat-free diets, or almost entirely fat-free. But what happens in animals is that they develop rough coats, red eyes, deterioration of all of their external surfaces, deterioration of their gut, inability to absorb nutrients properly. So then they become sick, and they'll eventually die without omega-6 and a small amount of omega-3 fat. But so they so we there this is why the researchers Burr and Burr, I can't think of their first names, but they were husband and wife way back in the 1920s, when back in the time, as I mentioned, that this was a time when researchers felt that we didn't require any fat in our diet whatsoever. And they completely extracted all the fat out of foods that they put various animals on, mostly rodents. And it's a very complicated process that has to be done in a lab to actually remove all of the fat, because if you don't remove it all, you'll end up with omega-6 linoleic acid and omega-3 alpha linolenic acid in the fat, because all natural fats contain it. It doesn't matter if it comes from, you know, if you're talking about white rice or oranges or apples, they've got fat, and all of those have fat, and they will contain omega-6 and omega-3. So we only need a tiny amount. And so Burr figured out that animals could not survive on a fat-free diet. They become sick and they would die prematurely. All right, but it takes a while, because eventually you have to remove, you know, you have to use up all of your stored omega-6 and omega-3 in your own body before you become severely deficient, right? And so it depends on how much you have in your body to begin with. All right, but if you look at, and I've got a graph here, you can see that Americans in 1865, we modeled their omega-6 consumption. They were at about 2.4 grams of omega-6 linoleic acid per day. And that's about 1.1% of calories. But animals and even humans don't need more than about 0.5%. And there's been an argument made by ancestral researchers that we need only as little as about 0.35% omega-6 linoleic acid. Because that's what hunter-gatherers are consuming. Yeah.
Okay, so what you're saying is hunter-gatherers are estimated to consume never more than 2%, and we probably only need at most 0.5% of our calories to come from these omega-6s.
That's right. We might need a little bit more than 0.5% as infants, after infancy, probably no one needs more than 0.5%. And we certainly don't need anything above about 1.6 to 2% is excess. And as I mentioned early on, you know, there's a sweet spot, there's an optimal consumption of every single nutrient there is, you know, water, oxygen, iron, copper, molybdenum, you name it, they all need to be consumed at an appropriate dose.
Yeah, and not too much, too little.
Exactly. Either way is dangerous. Mm-hmm. And so if we go back to this graph, you can see that, again, we were at 1.1% omega-6 in 1865 when we didn't have any chronic disease. And in 1909, that had doubled to 2.23% or gone from 2.4 grams. That should say 4.8 grams. That's a misprint there. By 1999, you can see we were at 7.21% of our diet as omega-6 or 18 grams a day. In 2008, 11.8% of our diet is omega-6 and 29 grams a day. And you can, if you overlay our obesity, our coronary heart disease, our cancer, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, Alzheimer's, dementia, macular degeneration, all of them are intimately related to this right here. They're related to the seed oil consumption and to the omega-6 consumption.
I want to ask you something about this graph. It's triggering me about something else that I've been researching. So for those just listening, right, we're looking at the percentage of calories that come from omega-6 fatty acids over time. And, you know, you go back to the 1800s and forward to the present, and it's just a line going up and to the right. But at about 1999, right at the turn of the millennium, that goes up even faster. So the slope of the graph gets much steeper. What's interesting about this to me, Dr. Kenobi, and I'd love your take on this, is I know that from about 99, 2000 to present, our total caloric intake wasn't really rising anymore. We were no longer consuming more total calories. And in fact, some of our nutrients, our total fat consumption, and I think our carb consumption, you know, either plateaued or even started to drop off around this time. And yet we know that the obesity epidemic kept getting worse. And so do you think that this is a key piece of that puzzle there, that even though we weren't continuing to eat more after 2000, we were continuing to eat more seed oils?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Nick. And I've got graphs on that too, but I can, most of this is in my memory. And these are key points that you're bringing up. And you're exactly right. Right around 1999 or 2000, caloric consumption started to just slightly decline, whether you look at total calories available or calories consumed began to decline at right around 2000. Again, while obesity was 30 some percent in 1999. I think it was 31%. And then we're at 2018, we're at 42.5%, right? But the calories didn't go up.
Yeah.
And if you think, well, but it was the sugar. No, after 2000, either 1999 or 2004, right in there, depending on two slightly different data sets, sugar has been on the decline in the United States. And so again, sugar on the decline while obesity goes through the roof, and diabetes going through the roof, by the way. And then you say, well, it's the carbohydrates. Well, carbohydrates, at least from 1997 through 2013, declined also. So you have total calories, carbohydrates and sugar all declining, while obesity and diabetes go even at a more vertical ascent.
Yeah. Well, that's
what do you think is going true in other nations too?
Yeah. What do you think is going on there mechanistically? So if diabetes is insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes is insulin resistance, insulin goes up after blood sugar goes up, and blood sugar goes up after we eat carbohydrates. So if carb intake did not continue rising, but diabetes did continue rising, how can we explain that?
Oh, I can explain it easy. So for those who want to investigate further, I went over the pathway between oxidation and insulin resistance in a presentation I gave at the Ancestral Health Symposium in 2019, which was at the University of California, San Diego. And basically what, and I'm going to keep this pretty simple, and if you want me to get more in depth, I can, but I think it's really difficult for people just listening. But in a nutshell, when you consume high omega-6, you damage these molecules called cardiolipin, which are key players inside the inner mitochondrial membrane. And that inner mitochondrial membrane has to hold a proton gradient. The protons are hydrogen ions. And so that inner mitochondrial membrane, the way it produces energy is you pump these hydrogen protons inside the membrane and it builds up a gradient. And so that has power. And when those hydrogen protons come back through the membrane, they go through ATP synthase. That's the final step in the electron transport pathway. And when they come through there, that converts ADP, adenosine diphosphate, to ATP, adenosine triphosphate, ATP, the energy currency of the cell. And so, but what happens when you consume a high omega-6 diet is it damages that cardiolipin, causes the membrane to become leaky, and or changes the curvature of it. And that causes failure of that membrane. It allows, for one thing, those protons to leak out of the inner mitochondrial matrix. And therefore, you cannot produce energy. Hmm. And the very next thing that happens is that you increase the reactive oxygen species, and that causes the cell to become sick. The cell then becomes insulin resistant. It's the very next step. And if you think the cell is a microcosm of the entire body, so when the cell becomes insulin resistant, the entire body becomes insulin resistant. And this is exactly why it's not about carbohydrates and it's not about sugar. Sugar may cause this in extraordinary doses to some degree, but it takes like the doses they're using are like 60% of the diet. It's insane. It makes no sense. There's nobody in the world consuming that much sugar. But anyway, so you can explain all of this, or at least I can, I believe, through a high omega-6 diet. You don't need any sugar and you don't need high carbohydrates. All you need is substantial vegetable oils, and you will drive mitochondrial dysfunction, which is what I'm talking about, through oxidation, and you will drive insulin resistance, which will cause your blood sugar to go up. And it doesn't matter what your macronutrient ratios are, that's irrelevant.
Is there preclinical evidence demonstrating that if you have a very high omega-6 diet, that you can cause insulin resistance without changing?
It's all in animals. Yeah, the answer, in animals, they absolutely have proven that. And I reviewed that in those studies. And this is why they see several studies, in very good studies in animals, where they gave the animals isocaloric diets. And all they varied was one thing, omega-6 linoleic acid. Everything else was kept equivalent. Calories, fat, carbohydrates, sugar, or even no sugar, zero sugar. And the animals given the 19% soybean oil diet, for example, become massive, you know, which even on, again, same calories as the rodents given chow, which is like 1% omega-6 linoleic acid versus the rodents given 19% soybean oil, which is about 11% omega-6 linoleic acid, and in fact, lower than typical Americans. Yeah. Those rodents on that diet, the high omega-6, they become massively obese. But there's only one difference. And even when they have zero sugar, they become morbidly obese. It's the equivalent that in I think it was 8 months' time, they become the equivalent of a 277-pound male versus the rodents on chow would be the equivalent of a 170-pound man. Mm-hmm. This is the difference. Yeah.
So you're saying basically researchers have a bunch of different groups of mice. Each one gets a different diet. They all have the same number of calories. They're all eating the same number of calories each day, but they're just varying the fat profile and the macronutrient profile of these diets. You're saying that the mice who get the high soybean oil diet, which is giving them high omega-6 fats at roughly the levels that, you know, a lot of Americans are eating today, those mice get obese and they get sick compared to the other mice, even though the other mice are eating the exact same total amount of calories.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And so a key thing here is mitochondrial function. The mitochondria are the little organelles in our cells that create the energy, the ATP molecules that power everything. And if you mess with their ability to do that, the cell is just going to basically get sick in almost any way you can think of, because it's not going to be able to effectively and efficiently produce its energy. Is that a fair kind of summary of that?
That is perfect, Nick. By the way, I should have told you this at the beginning. I'm sorry, but please call me Chris. No, I don't let anybody call me doctor. So I forgot to mention that, Nick.
All right, no worries, Chris. What is the connection between omega-6 fatty acids like linoleic acid and inflammation? Why do people say that the omega-6s cause inflammation? What's going on biochemically there?
Yeah, they do. That's another. So there's really, I tell people that there's basically four pathways through which high omega-6 diets drive overweight, obesity, and chronic disease. And it's that they are highly, the seed oils are highly pro-oxidative, pro-inflammatory, directly toxic, which we've already talked about that through the advanced lipid oxidation end products. And then they're nutrient deficient. They don't contain vitamins A, D, and K2. Like you would get in traditional animal fats like lard, butter, and beef tallow. So in terms of the pro, you know, omega-6 as being pro-inflammatory, they absolutely are. And, you know, before I describe that, which basically everybody agrees with this, nobody even argues that at all, that the omega-6s are pro-inflammatory, but I want to just put this into perspective. The oxidation that we were talking about, I think, is tenfold, maybe a hundredfold more dangerous than the inflammation. Oxidation is incredibly damaging to the body. And this is it's much harder to understand, which we just talked about what it does to the mitochondria, for example, and how it leads to devastation and mitochondrial dysfunction, which could lead to obesity and diabetes and cancer. But you have the inflammatory pathway too. Well, so how do we get there? So omega-6 linoleic acid is an 18-carbon fat that is converted by elongase and desaturase enzymes into 20-carbon arachidonic acid. Mm-hmm. And that arachidonic acid then gives rise to inflammatory prostaglandins, eicosanoids, leukotrienes, and thromboxanes. Mm-hmm. These are collectively vasoconstrictive, inflammatory, and cause clotting. All right.
So vasoconstrictive means you're going to have higher blood pressure when those things go up. Inflammation is inflammation. I think everyone kind of has a sense for what that is. And then they're also clotting factors.
Yes. Yeah. And in other words, you're putting yourself at risk that day when you consume vegetable oils for heart attack and stroke that day. And this is one thing that we can get into this, you know, about recovery from vegetable oils, but you put yourself at risk, you know, right away when you consume vegetable oils for these reasons. And then the you know, just on the flip side, the omega-3s, then they're the opposite. They're you know, the omega-3 alpha linolenic acid, and then the downstream metabolites, the longer chain omega-3s, EPA and DHA, 20 and 22 carbons respectively. Those eventually they give rise to you know, anti-inflammatory prostaglandins, protectins, maricins, and so they're ultimately they prevent vasoconstriction, or you know, or they'll produce vasodilation. They prevent inflammation or reverse it, and they are anti-clotting essentially. Mm-hmm. So they have the opposite effect. And this is where this is boilerplate stuff in pathophysiology. Everybody knows that these are, you know, well accepted mechanisms. Mm-hmm.
So I have a question for you, which is this, you know, basically after everything that we've just talked about, you just gave us a nice crash course in omega-6s versus omega-3s. As you just said, like, everybody knows this stuff who's studied this area of biology. Why, if I go to the grocery store, I will see all sorts of bags, all sorts of boxes that have the American Heart Association's Heart Healthy stamp of approval on them for the specific reason that they contain what they call heart healthy polyunsaturated fats. What is they can't just be making this up out of nowhere. Why is it that the AMA is calling these things heart healthy if what you're telling us is basically the opposite?
For one reason, they lower cholesterol, and that's it. And I've you know, started with this early on in a number of my presentations that the American Medical Association, Harvard School of Public Health, Tufts University Nutrition Department, Mayo Clinic's Nutrition Department, Cleveland Clinic, American Heart Association, on, all recommend seed oils, and they all recommend them because they improve, and I'll put this in, I should put this in single quotes, improve our cholesterol, meaning they lower our cholesterol. And so they therefore are deemed as good. Well, guess what? You know, anything that's highly pro-oxidative but a number of things that are pro-oxidative will also lower your cholesterol. But so as we talked about early on, when your LDL cholesterol oxidizes, it's taken up out of the bloodstream into the vascular wall. And the reason that it is probably is because when the LDL is oxidized, it's extremely dangerous. And so those are rapidly removed from the blood. And so it does potentially lower your cholesterol. Now, it may also be that some of the LDL that is oxidized is still there, but it doesn't measure as normal LDL either. Because when it's oxidized, it looks different in terms of, you know, the testing. So it may also, to some degree, still be there, and yet it's just not being measured properly, as I understand it, because mm-hmm. of the fact that it is oxidized.
Yeah. Based on everything I know and I've learned, you know, over the past few years about metabolism, about cholesterol, about the history of medicine, a fair summary of what many people, including you, I think would say is the standard story that we've been told about the relationship between cardiovascular disease and cholesterol is wrong, or at the very least, very lacking in the appropriate level of nuance. And it's simply not true that lowering your cholesterol is going to be good for everyone all the time. Is that accurate? And if so, why is the story persisting with such vigor?
You know, because orthodox allopathic medicine, and I was trained in their institutions. I'm a graduate of University of Colorado School of Medicine, which is an allopathic school of medicine, of course, and traditional medical school. They have been supporting this theory, this hypothesis or belief system that cholesterol itself drives coronary heart disease, and so it just needs to be lower. And of course, the research shows over and over, and I think this gets to be a boring topic, Nick, but because I feel like we've gone over and over and over this, but no matter how low you make the cholesterol, you can't prevent coronary heart disease if that LDL is oxidized. Mm-hmm. So they're missing the main point of the fact that why is it so hard for them to look at this and just see that, all of these ancestrally living populations, whether it's the Inuit who consumed almost carnivores, or whether you look at Papua New Guineans of Tukasinta who were consuming almost nothing but sweet potatoes, or you look at South Pacific Islanders who live off of fish, starchy tubers, fruit, and fruit mostly, and coconut, and the half of their diet, coconut, and on and on, all these diets that don't contain vegetable oils, they don't have heart disease, right? And typically their cholesterol levels are really, they're pretty low. Just like the Maasai warriors of Kenya and Tanzania, they were shown to have, their cholesterol is pretty low. I think it's, I forget the numbers, but it's under 200. Mm-hmm. I think it's 160 or 180 or something like that is what it was when George Mann studied them back in 1972. And everybody's scratching their head. How can they consume 66% of their diet as animal fat and have no heart disease? Mm-hmm. At least no coronary heart disease that ends in heart attack or congestive heart failure, right? Mm-hmm. And so, but it's, to me, it's just very simple. They don't have vegetable oils. They have a very low omega-6 diet. And so they don't have oxidized LDL. And one of the things that people are not really talking much about that I think is the main reason our cholesterol can end up so high is one thing, and it's copper deficiency. Hmm. And James DeNicolantonio reviewed this in his book. I think it's called The Mineral Fix. It's a really big book, but it's a great resource. And our diets are really low in copper if you're not consuming some of the things that are high in copper. And there's not very many things, but it includes liver, lentils, some beans, and chocolate. And those are some of the few things that contain significant copper. And I know a fair bit about this because I was copper deficient myself and had very high cholesterol, like 300 to 500.
That's very high.
Yeah, and I've been like that since going clear back to when I was in my early 30s. And, and it corrected only with one thing. I have zero coronary heart disease. I have a coronary artery calcium scan in 2020, and it was zero. It had no calcium plaque whatsoever.
Were your doctors shocked when they saw that, knowing what your cholesterol?
Well, I don't go to doctors.
Oh, how did you?
I mean, not for that anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I just ordered my own. Anybody can order their own coronary artery calcium scan and go in and have it. That you can get them here in Denver for like $100.
Oh wow.
So they're very inexpensive and a really good thing to do. But yeah, so I'm a perfect case. Why would my total cholesterol average 380 or something like that, for 25, 30 years, and yet I have absolutely zero coronary artery disease? Well, for one thing, we always cooked our own food, and I didn't use vegetable oils. I didn't know what I was doing most of that time until 2011, but I wasn't using vegetable oils, and I think this is the reason why. But I was copper deficient. So if people will consume copper-rich foods for a period of time, and you might want to measure your copper, but I didn't mean to go down this pathway so much, Nick, but just since we're on the subject. But mm-hmm. but if you raise your if you're low in copper and you raise your copper, I can almost guarantee you your cholesterol will normalize.
Interesting. So quick question for you before we move on to a different subject. You presumably weren't concerned about having a heart attack or anything like that when you noticed that your cholesterol levels were that high. But what was concerning you? Why did you want to look into bringing them down?
I really wasn't trying to bring it down. I didn't actually know for sure about any of this. I just began to consume more liver for other reasons, and liver is a really good source of copper, whereas muscle meat, like hamburger and steak, for example, and chicken and fish, all that, they're very low in copper.
I see.
So the muscle meats are low in copper, but organ meat, well, at least liver, is high in copper. So let me put this another way. So the muscle meats are high in zinc and iron, mm-hmm. and low in copper, and liver is high in copper and low in zinc and iron. Mm. And interestingly, zinc and possibly iron, but zinc is a strong competitor for absorption with copper in the gut. And so if you consume a lot of zinc and copper together, or if you take zinc supplements or just zinc-rich foods, you can further deplete your copper.
Oh.
And that's this is a huge reason that we have so much high cholesterol. This doesn't have anything to do with oxidation of cholesterol, right? This is a separate subject. Mm-hmm. But this is why I think we have very high cholesterol levels, and people, a lot of people who go on a meat rich diet, particularly when they go low carb, for example, their cholesterol goes through the roof, and there's all this speculation about what it is. And I think it's primarily just that they eliminated a lot of the foods where they were getting their copper.
Not only are they not getting that copper if they're not eating things like liver, but the ingestion of that food is high in zinc, and you're saying that's going to competitively inhibit the absorption of copper.
That's exactly right.
Interesting. And I guess, the instinct most people would have there is to say that type of diet is going to increase cholesterol because you're getting more saturated fat or something.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. And there's a component of that, but I think it's mild compared to the copper issue, because people have gone, I know so many cases like this, it's a lot of anecdote, but there's research behind this as well. But when people go low carb, for example, a lot of times they think that their cholesterol is going through the roof because of saturated fat, just as you said, but they've eliminated, let's say, a lot of things in the plant world where they were getting the copper that they were getting. For example, almost half of the copper that's being consumed in the United States is coming from chocolate.
Hmm.
Almost half. And so if you go low carb, people eliminate chocolate, right?
Yeah,
that's probably
yeah, yeah.
one of the things that they're going to eliminate. And because they're eliminating that because of because it's usually going to have sugar with it.
Hmm.
And so this, they're eliminating a potential good source of copper there.
Interesting. This is completely coincidental, because I didn't know about this copper thing that you've just been telling me about. But I've got a bag of like organic, cacao powder, and several days a week I stir it into some milk and hot water, and I just have like a little hot chocolate. And I had noticed when I bought it that it had a lot of copper in it, and you don't see copper in a lot of nutrition labels. So I didn't really look into it. It was just a curiosity. But this is an interesting coincidence.
Yeah, it's a great source of copper. Yeah, by far the best source is beef liver, I'm sure other ruminant livers mm-hmm. are probably high as well, but the common one would be beef liver.
What kind of diet do you eat, and is there anything that you're really aiming for beyond say the elimination or the minimization of the omega-6 fatty acids?
Yeah, so I eat and recommend an ancestral diet, and that just means that I've eliminated processed foods. I just don't consume hardly any processed food. I certainly don't eat any vegetable oils of any type Actually, I don't even consume now. If I were to consume any, it would be, it'd be coconut oil or maybe a little bit of olive oil, but those are key for me. So I actually over the last I mean, my diet has changed a lot over the last 12 years, but currently I've reduced my amount of protein. I've dropped, my total meat consumption down to maybe 12 ounces, 10 or 12 ounces a day, and increased the foods from the plant world. So I'm on what many would probably think of as a high carb diet, but it's probably around 40, 45% carbohydrate, maybe 30% fat or less, and the rest protein. So, but I consume lots of plantains, sweet potatoes, potatoes, some rice, some pasta, lots of fruits, apples, oranges, strawberries, berries, blueberries, and then a number of fermented foods, sauerkraut, kimchi, yogurt, kefir. Those are the things. And I'll, so basically that's basically what my diet is like currently.
And so, I with an eye towards thinking about reducing omega-6 intake and getting some of those fatty acids out of the body. Let's say that you're the typical American today, and you're eating something like a 20-to-1 ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids. And let's just say that you snap your fingers and you get it down to a 1-to-1 ratio or something close to that. How long would it actually take the body to adapt to that, for its fatty acid composition to reflect that new ratio of omega-6 to omega-3s?
Yeah, 3 years.
3 years.
3 years. Yeah. So the half-life of fatty acids in the body is 600 to 680 days, and so roughly 2 years for the half-life. But interestingly, one study firmly showed that you could turn over all of your body fat, fatty acids in 3 years. This is in humans, of course. So for somebody, our diet should be less than 2% omega-6 linoleic acid, and that would produce there. We haven't gotten into this so much, but you're again, as we talked about, it's reflective of the amount of omega-6 linoleic acid in your body fat. And that would produce, and there's four studies that show this, only four, all done in 1969 by Ian Pryor and colleagues in the South Pacific. So these four populations had their body fat analyzed, and they were on completely ancestral diets, and their body fat averaged 2.82% omega-6 linoleic acid. Americans were at 9.1% omega-6 linoleic acid in 1959. We were at 21.5% omega-6 linoleic acid. Again, this is now is in our body fat, right? So this is our body fat. So it should be 2.8% roughly. We were at 9.1% in 1959. We're at 21.5% in 2008, right? I just want to make this really clear. So we want to be back to 2.8%, but our half-life is 2 years, and we can turn over all of our fatty acids in 3 years. So if you go on a completely, you get rid of all vegetable oils and you consume, only low omega-6 foods, which we haven't gone into all that yet, but there's more to that. But so you can be back down to your, theoretically back down to 2.8% omega-6 linoleic acid in your body fat in 3 years. So that's kind of maybe good news, bad news, depending on how you look at it. It's not going to happen overnight, but you'll get there, and you will realize that you'll gradually realize all the benefits of a low omega-6 diet over that time. And the only thing I know, people say, well, is there any way to speed up this process? And the only way I know would be, I would say potentially this might be a reason to consider a lower fat, higher carbohydrate diet, and then exercise.
Yeah, you know, burn it off faster.
Yeah, you're ultimately going to need to burn the omega-6, use it for fuel, essentially, to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's talk about this more. How do people get there? How do people get closer to a balanced ratio of omega-6 and omega-3s and not overconsume these omega-6s?
Yeah, and the whole theory about balancing, it won't work. It won't help you at all, in my view, or almost not at all, just to increase your omega-3, which could theoretically balance your omega-6 to omega-3 ratio. That won't solve the problem because you still are going to have a body full of omega-6 fat, right?
Yeah. And this you have to get there. You have to get to that balance ratio by bringing the omega-6s down.
Exactly.
And you know, not being omega-3 deficient, but you can't just bring up the omega-3 super high.
Right. So the way you get there is you've got to just, I would say, in one sentence, you have to prepare your own food without vegetable oils, and make your fats, your added fats, primarily animal fat, like butter, beef tallow, ghee, whatever, but it should be animal fats. And this is what we hadn't talked about yet, is that the animals need to have been consuming an ancestral diet, which means that the animals that are monogastric, which would be like pigs and chickens, those animals will develop a very high omega-6 in their body fat, just like humans, because we don't have multi-compartment stomachs that can hydrogenate the polyunsaturated fats into saturated and monounsaturated fats. Cows, cattle, ungulates, ruminants, whatever you want to call them, they have a multi-compartment stomach. One of those stomachs can convert the omega-6 into monounsaturated and saturated fats, and they therefore have a very low body fat omega-6, no matter what they're eating.
Yeah. So ruminants like cows are just intrinsically different in their metabolic capabilities than things like chickens and pigs. So they will almost always have a much lower omega-6 content, but the diet of the animal is going to reflect the fat content of the animal is going to reflect the diet of the animal. So if you're buying chickens that are fed corn, they're going to have high omega-6 content.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're just like they'll be just like humans. If they're fed a high omega-6 diet, they're going to have high omega-6 in their body fat, and then we consume those and we're going to elevate our omega-6 in our body fat. And there's a similar mechanism behind consuming nuts. So nuts and seeds are high in omega-6. So nuts and nut oils are, except for macadamia nuts and macadamia nut oil, that's the only one in the nut in all of the nuts that's low in omega-6. All the others are high. And so those three things, so the seed oils, even some of the fruit, even you might consider olive oil and avocado oil, they're a little bit higher in omega-6. And then, of course, you've got monogastric animals. If you're consuming those that are consuming corn and soy, so again, we're talking about pigs and chickens that consume corn and soy, that will drive up your omega-6. And then consuming nuts and seeds will drive up your omega-6. So you need to get all of those corrected, and then your omega-6 will really start dropping, and it'll drop. I think it'll drop precipitously in a few months. And, people just start noticing all kinds of health benefits when they do this.
So what is your relationship to nuts? Nuts that don't have added vegetable oils to them, but do have natural omega-6 content.
Well, they're incredibly better than, consuming nuts of any type would be incredibly better than consuming the highly polyunsaturated vegetable oils, because they're not processed in a factory that would, ultimately drive the development of those advanced lipid oxidation end products before you ever even eat them, right? Mm-hmm. And so you wouldn't have that issue, but I'm convinced that people who consume most of their fat in the form of nuts, I've seen some disastrous health outcomes with those people. Mm-hmm. And I think it's mostly because of the high omega-6, but they're also, and we've really never got into this too much, but nuts and vegetable oils, none of those have the fat soluble vitamins A, D, and K2, which you would get in beef tallow or beef fat, or even to some degree pork fat. Mm-hmm. You know, so you're missing those too if you're not, if you're just, you know, you're trying to get your fat from nuts, for example. That's a dangerous proposition. Mm-hmm. in terms of a diet.
One final area before we run out of time that I want to get you talking about is the brain, and maybe we can get there by talking about the eyes, because that's your specialty as an ophthalmologist. What happens to our vision and our eyes and to our brains if we have too much omega-6 in the diet?
Well, I think it's this. I think, in a nutshell, I'm kind of on the spot here, Nick, because it's kind of how we started out. That I'm stumped as to where to go with this, because there's so much to tell. But I wanted to say that the most important consideration is to keep your mitochondria healthy. Mm-hmm. And you know, we do that through an ancestral diet, period. And that means no vegetable oils and essentially no sugar, no refined flours, which means that your diet is not only nutrient dense, you know, it has all the vitamins and minerals that you need, but it also doesn't have the toxic components. And so, you know, I think that if we could just draw some big parallels between the brain and the eye or the retina, they're all subject to the same insults in terms of oxidative attack and lack of nutrition. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, in the eye, in the retina, one of the most important things that happens when people consume seed oils, I believe, is probably damage to the mitochondria that ultimately causes destruction of the retinal pigment epithelium, which is what supports the retina proper, the rods and cones. And so when you actually see the retinal pigment epithelium, or the called the RPE, you actually see what we ophthalmologists would call atrophy of that layer. And when you see RPE, we see that, we call it RPE dropout or atrophy. And when you lose, each RPE cell supports about 30 photoreceptors, rods and cones. And so when one RPE cell dies, 30 photoreceptors die with it. And neither of these are regenerative. They don't come back. Right. And so this is one of the main pathways to macular degeneration, is this right here. Now, there's many other pathways that I don't know that we should try to get into all that. That's detail that probably almost no one wants to hear. But I think that, but and there must be, you know, very similar pathways in the brain itself. But that's definitely not my area of expertise. But, you know, interestingly, if we just talked about Alzheimer's for a moment. Alois Alzheimer, the physician, diagnosed the first case of what was eventually called Alzheimer's disease in 1908. And then I think there was another four cases diagnosed in 1910 or 1911. And then, you know, by the 1940s, there was several hundred cases. And, you know, today there's, you know, as of about 2020, I think there was 55 million cases of either Alzheimer's or dementia in the world, and another 10 million cases per year added. This is a new case of Alzheimer's or dementia every 3 seconds. But, you know, the one thing that's, our genetics haven't changed, right? And they've not changed at all in a century. But what's changed drastically is our diet. And the main thing that's changed is the vegetable oils. Hmm.
Yeah. So it sounds like, you know, I was just reading a paper by Bob Lustig and some other people, and they go over the concept of obesogens. And what they did was they compared and contrast various different models that people have used to explain how metabolic dysfunction and things like diabetes and obesity arise. And, you know, there's the energy balance molecule, which basically just says the more calories you eat, the bigger you're going to get energy in, energy out. There's the carbohydrate insulin model, which is the classic model of how things like carbohydrates and sugars raise insulin levels and cause insulin resistance. And they sort of say that they don't really like those two models very much. And they have a model that combines the obesogen model, and an obesogen is just things that we eat which cause metabolic problems. And then there's the sort of reduction oxidation model. And basically what they come to is they say, we think that a lot of the metabolic problems we're having today is that we're eating obesogens that are having their obesogenic effect in large part through changing things like the levels of oxidative stress that our cells are exposed to. And if I'm hearing you correctly, it sounds at least directionally like you would have basically that viewpoint.
Again, I would say that the primary obesogen would be seed oils.
Yeah.
That would be it. You know, and you know, there's a lot of concern about many other obesogens, and everything from, you know, stress, lack of sleep, various endocrine disruptors, for example, like plastics.
Yep.
Right. And but interestingly, the top five most obese and diabetic nations in the world are all South Pacific Island countries. And these countries, we were just down there evaluating their food supply. I'm going to stop this screen share if that's okay. We can come back to it anytime. But we were just there in October and November. Evaluating the food supply and some ancestrally living populations down there. But for example, what we found in Samoa, which is, I think, about number two or three, the most obese and diabetic nation in the world, their total obesity, overweight and obesity is about 90%. And diabetes is almost 30% in adults. So it's just outrageously high. And what we discovered was that they're consuming our oils primarily. Their traditional oil or food was coconut oil. Mm-hmm. Much of their diet came from coconuts, and they would make coconut cream. They didn't actually make the oil, but the coconut cream is where you get all the coconut fat. That's the coconut oil, right? It just hasn't been removed directly from the cream. But anyway. So they're consuming our oils, like our soybean and canola oil and safflower oil primarily, instead of coconut oil, because we've told them, Americans, you know, and they've been listening to our science, that they shouldn't be consuming coconut oil because it's high in saturated fat.
Yep. And that'll raise your cholesterol. So it all comes back to that. That
belief system. And they bought into this hook, line, and sinker. And to this day, the grocers down there even told us that the rich people they're the ones that primarily buy the canola and soybean oil. They're the ones that want that the most. It's more expensive than the other oils, but they've been told it's better. Right. So, I forgot how I got onto that, Nick, but
yeah, you were just talking about the most obese populations and,
the obesogens. I know why I mentioned that is because these islands are pretty darn pristine
in terms of the plastics and things.
In terms of the things that we think, you know, in terms of the environment, pollutants and all this. And of course, you know, I don't know about their stress or their sleep or whatever, but
those other things are probably lower than they are for us, and they're even more obese.
They're even more obese than America. So if you look at only developed nations, United States is the most obese nation in the world. But if you look at all nations, you know, developed and developing, it's the Pacific Islands that are the top five most obese and diabetic.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. And, you know, I guess the drivers of the supply of these things are pretty clear, I would think, to most people, right? Like, we've just devoted a lot of agriculture to creating these crops that can be used to basically cheaply make these things. And so there's a pretty straight arrow you can drive in terms of the supply to the demand. And because it's so, it makes foods so cheap and convenient to consume, because we can process them and package them in boxes and wrappers and yeah. on the go stuff, you know, that these things have just become pervasive, and they're in virtually everything.
Yeah, they're ubiquitous. Yeah.
Well, I don't want to take too much more of your time, Chris. Is there anything that you want to reiterate that we talked about, or anything you want to point people to that maybe they can go to read more, or that will teach them about something we didn't really have time to get into on this general subject of seed oils and omega-6s and general metabolic health?
Yes, thanks for asking. So for those who can see this, this is our new book, my new book. I have a co-author, Suzanne Alexander, but it's called The Ancestral Diet Revolution. This came out in last summer. And this book reviews basically everything that we've talked about today, but in much greater detail. Or something like 80 graphs that in the book, most of which I produced along with colleagues, and so it's science, but it's very readable, and the pictures really the graphs and the tables really drive the point home. We do have social media. I don't handle that. Suzanne Alexander does, but so we have Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, now known as X, right? And we have so I work for two nonprofit foundations, Cure AMD Foundation, that's for macular degeneration, and Ancestral Health Foundation. The latter does not have a website yet, but these are the nonprofit organizations that we work for. Those are the places that people can go to look for more. But it's a shameless plug on the book, because we don't earn any income from that at all. That income, the royalties from that book, go directly into the foundations, and from that just supports operations and research. I don't earn anything from working in this field. I'm just here because I believe in this mission.
All right. Well, Dr. Chris Kenobi, thanks again for your time. This was really important.
Thanks so much, Nick. I really appreciate it.
Hey, everyone. I want to take a minute to tell you about a really cool health monitoring device I've been using for several weeks. It's called Lumen, and it's a handheld, pocket-sized device with a sleek design. It measures CO2 levels in your breath, which allows their technology to determine the extent to which your body is burning fats versus carbohydrates. Lumen helps improve your metabolic flexibility, your body's efficiency in shifting between using fats and carbs. It improves your ability to burn fat, which decreases your hunger levels and makes your body less dependent on snacking, and it can increase your energy levels by helping you develop a high-functioning metabolism. I use this device in the morning, before bed, and after meals and workouts to track my metabolism. With just a couple weeks of use, I learned a lot about which foods were causing my body to burn mostly fat, mostly carbs, or both, as well as how long I need to fast each day to promote fat burning. Lumen is great for anyone looking to optimize their health for either weight loss or athletic performance. The easy-to-use app allows you to track your results together with what you're eating and how you're exercising, and it syncs with other devices like the Apple Watch. Click the link in the episode description to learn more, and use the code MIND, MIND, in all capital letters, to get $50 off your Lumen device today.